Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. It's a very special day today in India because it happens to be the day of the Indian independence. And one of the best tributes we can pay as Indians to the Indian independence, I think, is to truly become independent. And Swami says, true independence comes only when you are independent. Meaning, you're dependent on what is within you. Because it is divinity that pervades one and all. And it's only when you are truly dependent on only the divinity, can you be truly independent. Otherwise, it is still dependence. So, we hope that this day marks the beginning of our journey towards true freedom. And not just political, social and all other kinds of freedom associated with the body and the mind. With that brief introduction, we will go back to a text which I'm sure will help us progress towards this idea of true independence and true freedom, because these are words of wisdom from the avatar directly. We are into the next section of conversations with Swami, conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, documented by Dr. John Hislop. Last week, we were talking about how Swami responded to a few detractors and critics who actually challenged him, saying that they were also spiritual masters and they were spiritual masters with much greater powers. We saw about the rise and fall of all such spiritual masters who possibly feigned spirituality, who possibly, as Swami put it, got some progress, but that progress went into their head. They became vain, they became proud, they became egoistic, and in the process forgot the journey on which they had embarked, got derailed, and therefore had an inevitable fall. So that was where we had left off, and that is where we will continue from. As we said last week, there was a topic change, and that's why we had stopped it there. There is a change in topic, and we shall continue. The conversation gets very, very interesting, and just like last week, this week too is very, very relevant to the times we live in now, in the physical absence of Swami, and we're really grateful to Swami for, you know, in a way anticipating these doubts, questions and problems that are going to arise possibly 50 years down the line and answering them well in advance for all of us. So with gratitude and love at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, we will begin today, and let me welcome Brother Prem also to join us. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and very, very true, whatever Swami is speaking in this episode that we're going to cover and what Swami spoke the last time around, also very relevant and very timely reminders. You know, it's one thing to say that people go astray or people get carried away, but the other thing is it is quite natural. You know, the mind is such that it gets bored easily, the mind needs change, the mind needs variety, and it is quite possible that it goes after different people, different words, different ways of explaining the same spirituality, and we get fascinated by that. But I think what's important is to pull ourselves back and remind ourselves whose words we are reading. As I was telling a group the other day when we were talking to them, you know, a few months back I had the opportunity to go to Gangotri. You know, it's a grueling drive. It took, of course, we had a bad driver. That was added trouble that we had. It took us.
You mean the birthplace of River Ganga?
It's exactly not the birthplace, but where the shrine for the, you know, the deity of Ganga is there. Mm-hmm. The Ganga Mata temple is there in Gangotri, but the actual birthplace is Gomukh, which is a further treacherous trek, right? So imagine even to go to Gangotri, which is pretty much accessible by road, you can go by a car. It took us something like 10 hours. We lost our way in the way and all that. And from Rishikesh, in the dead of the night, I mean, I can just recollect that journey even as I'm talking. It was very, very difficult. It was very tiresome, and we were quite lost in the way, all that. And finally, you go to Gangotri. The water is crystal clear. You know, you stand in front of that water. You forget all the journey. You say that it was worthwhile, Right? It was so clear, and if you trek a little up, you know, from the temple, you go to a spot where there are no people around. That's water, the purest Ganga in its purest form, and you can drink that water. It's like nothing that you'd have tasted before. Fresh and cold, coming from the glacier. Imagine you do a trek, something like that. You go to the purest source of water and drinking out of your mineral water bottle or the bottle that you've carried from the city. That's what I feel is what we're doing, you know, when we have had the opportunity to come face to face with the purest form of the message. Then we go in search of other, you know, packaged drinking water. That's what we're doing. All that it requires is to remind ourselves time and again whose message this is and from whom it has come. This is the very source, right? And it is quite common for the mind to get carried away, but I think it's our duty to every now and then remind ourselves. That's why Swami had told one of the lecturers, or Bhagya sir was once saying, either he asked this question or one of the VIPs in the portico had asked Swami this question when he was there. He had asked Swami, Swami, what is the sadhana that we have to do? We have this opportunity of being here with you. What is the sadhana that we have to do to ensure that we make best use of this opportunity? And Swami said, you just have to keep reminding yourself that Swami is God. Right? It seemed like a very simple thing. That, I mean, that's why we are all here. That's why we are thinking about Swami. That's why we sing bhajans. But Swami said, no, you keep forgetting it quite often. So the only sadhana worthwhile is keep reminding yourself that Swami is God. And this is what happens, because your mind gets distracted. And every time you remind, you say, why am I running after that? Why am I going after that? The source is here. The purest form is here. The most selfless form is here. And I think that is what we are seeing even in this discussion that we are having, I mean, Swami is having with Hislop. It's pure, it's fearless, and in so many places, Swami is very sharp. He cuts off and says that, no, that is not true. That is not the case. Now, even when Swami was talking to the students and making them answer some questions that Hislop had, Swami was very clear. He said, no, this is wrong. This is not the right thing. Even though, you know, we might have let it pass, and if it were us. So Swami is being very clear. Swami is being very, very,
precise.
Precise in the message that Swami is giving. So I think it's one of the most beautiful conversations that we are going through.
We will go through now directly, you know, Hislop is speaking to Swami and he says, in the car en route to Anantapur, an American who was teaching at the Satya Sai College at Vrindavan said, Swami, I feel guilty at leaving my classes. And I think possibly he's a visiting lecturer, and he's been called by Swami to travel somewhere, or he's traveling along with Swami, and so he's saying that that's my duty there and I feel guilty about leaving it. This is what we can understand from the conversation here. And Swami responds, duty in the world carries no force or weight. When God calls, God is the goal of life. When in His company, there is no duty. When He is absent on tour, etc., then duty comes into full play, because duty is God. When Swami says that when He is absent on tour, of course He is referring at that point in time to the physical frame. So, from in the physical frame, when Swami is allotting a task or giving a job, Swami is saying that there can be no worldly binding or force, because it is God's calling. And that is the ultimate goal in life, to do what God says. You know, I used to think that when all the students and staff who are either studying or working in Swami's institutions around, we would see when Swami had to travel either to Chennai or to Bombay or to Delhi, Shimla or Kodaikanal, wherever Swami travels, he would select a few members of the staff and the students to travel along with him. I don't think there was any protocol that you have to apply for leave and, you know, take permission and see if it's allowed, what is the progress of your doctorate. It is one thing that everybody would jump at that and would be waiting for the opportunity. In fact, if it came to that, people were ready to, you know, even give up their job and studies in order to be with Swami. You know, speaking of job and studies, it's so inspiring to know that there have been occasions when Swami was physically present, and people, youngsters, I know 2-3 youngsters at least, who were not given leave to come here and do Prashanti Seva, and they actually resigned from their jobs because they wanted to come here, do Prashanti Seva in Swami's physical presence. So Swami is making it very clear here that when God calls, God is the goal of life, so it's all fine. But when God is physically absent, then duty becomes God. I think this is such a nice, what they call that? Is it a cornerstone to go by, a touchstone to see by? Because the mind, you know, it's very, very hyper intelligent. It's very smart. It's over smart. It can twist things to suit what it desires. So therefore, now, you know, I make travel plans and travel here and there extensively, saying that I'm doing it for Swami. And when I'm doing it for Swami, it is justified that I don't, I mean, if I miss my duty also, it is not right. Because Swami is making it very clear here that when Swami is on tour, when Swami is physically absent, if you're not getting the the instruction directly from Swami, then your duty becomes God. You do your duty. But if you are accompanying Swami because Swami asked you to accompany, and in the process you are missing out taking on classes, don't worry. That is not binding. The duty in the world carries no force or weight.
You know, there's a very beautiful quote that I think we had sent out in Science Prize a couple of months back. Swami saying in that discourse about duty towards family, duty towards spouse and parents. And I think Swami, I might not be getting it exactly, where Swami says that the importance of duty, you know, you've been placed in a position where you're somebody's son, you're somebody's husband, you're somebody's sibling. So you have duties towards all of these people, and these have to be dispensed as precisely as possible. But then Swami goes on to say, but there is one condition where, you know, all of these duties can be given up. And he says, when God steps in. And then Swami gives the beautiful example of, you know, how Prahlada could disobey his father because, you know, God steps into that relationship. Similarly, Sakubai could disobey her mother-in-law, and, you know, three or four examples like that Swami gives. So Swami would always give that, you know, all of these duties are important, but they're not important on their own. They're important only because they lead you to God. Right? And in fact, Swami's Dharmavaini Swami speaks of that. Swami, when he defines Swadharma, usually Swadharma will be defined as your duty at that phase in life, your duty according to your profession, according to your relationship with others. Now Swami says, no, what takes you towards the ultimate goal is alone Swadharma. At that point, it might be you doing your duty as a son. But doing a duty as your son is not your Swadharma. Your Swadharma is always going towards the goal. And, you know, the way Swami puts it here, when Swami is there, and as you rightly said, one of the fondest memories for us is when Swami would come to Vrindavan when we were students. We would see how the whole class, the schedule would get realigned, you know, so that we get as much of Swami as possible. And all the more because Swami spends a very short time in Vrindavan. You know, all our, we would have no jogging when Swami is there.
Correct.
Because we could come for morning darshan, and all of that would get realigned. It would give a very beautiful feeling that, you know, this is a place where Swami is the center of your life. Everything revolves around Swami. We wouldn't go for evening games because Swami would keep us in Thrai till 6:30. It would get dark and we would not have the opportunity. But nothing mattered. That everything was revolving around Swami. I think that is the, as you rightly said, the touchstone that we need to keep. And reminded of a beautiful incident which Nanjanaya sir would say. When he came to Swami, he already had a family. They were living in Bangalore and all that. And he said that, no, this is the person for whom I need to work. So he had a step down in his career. He had to travel for 2 hours every day to come and teach the students in Vrindavan. Then eventually he started staying in Vrindavan. He would go visit his family only in the weekends. So because he said, you know, this is an opportunity and I don't want to leave this. And he narrates a beautiful incident when one Swami gives him a ring. Right? We must have seen that design of the ring where we call it the two-diamond ring. There are two diamonds, you know, in a single line. And Swami gives him that ring. And Swami tells him, see, when you go to your home, you go home walking with your hand on your forehead. Right? As though you're wiping your forehead. Why? Because the ring will be seen. The wife will see the ring and she'll ask, what is this? When did Swami give you? So Swami tells him, so when you walk into the house, you walk in like this, wiping your forehead. Then when your wife asks you, you tell her, yes, Swami gave me this ring. And tell her that Swami told me that this one diamond is me and the other diamond is Swami. And this is our relationship. Nobody is there in between.
Right? Wow.
So that was a message to him as well as to his family. And, you know, confirmation of what he felt, that, you know, this is the most important relationship. And, I mean, this is a confusion that most of us do have, but it's a gentle balance, right? Where Swami would, the same Swami would also, we know that the doctors in the hospital were not allowed to sit for darshan for longer than, you know, that period of time. Swami will come and say that your duty is waiting. But at the same time, when Swami says, there's nothing, no looking back. All duties have to be dropped.
Exactly. So it is left, if Swami says, that is your duty, go there, don't be here.
Correct.
Because I remember Brother Sai Prakash telling me when I joined the studio, why is it that you are going and sitting for darshan? Swami has given you a job here, you do this. What he did not know was, Swami had instructed me that whatever happens, your sadhana is to have darshan. That was the instruction to me, and therefore I would run for darshan. But he was, even his advice was coming from a good place, because Swami had told him, why is it that you are coming for all the darshans when I have given you a job there, you go there. So, you know, Swami tailor makes, personalizes and gives us what we have to do. And then, you know, when you were speaking about how everything would revolve around Swami, you know, when it comes to me, I'm saying that yes, for me it revolves around Swami. I'm sure even Brother Sai Prakash will tell the same, it revolves around Swami. But for me, it was to go and have darshan. And for him, it was to sit and work here, you know, possibly in the studio, do the editing or whatever. It was different. So, what we have to realize is, when somebody says, or if we think that somebody's life is revolving around Swami, you cannot define that by, if they do this, this and this alone, it is revolving around Swami. That, in doing that, we would be getting into dangerous waters of being judgmental. One's life can revolve around Swami and it can manifest in different ways. We just don't understand that. But at the same time, it is very clear that it's a two-way process. You know, God giving the instruction and we having the conviction that it is God's instruction. It is equally important. Swami would often say in his discourses that God's grace and blessings is the positive, while your effort and your understanding and your conviction, faith, is the negative. Only when positive and negative terminals come together is there a flow of electricity or current. So too, the conviction is so important, because even if Swami tells something, you know, it would often happen. So you ask something, Swami, what should I do? Swami will tell, go out and become a doctor. You know, now it totally depends on your conviction whether you take it as Veda Vakya and immediately complete that year and leave and go and become a doctor. Or you think that this is a test Swami is subjecting me to and I must tell, no Swami, I don't want to do, and you don't become a doctor. See, so much has got to do with the conviction and not just with what Swami is saying. Therefore, even to this day, I think that formula works. Because, you know, practically speaking, I had a person who came to me and he said that, I won't name the person or anything, but he just said that, you know, Swami came in my dream and said that, this is a girl I'm supposed to marry, so what should I do now? So I asked, why are you asking me? Swami told you what you should do. He's saying, no, no. Then he told the history of that girl where there's some problem in possibly the girl was a divorcee, and he was saying, I don't know how the parents will accept. If the parent don't accept, what should I do? He had so many worries and, you know, things running in his head. I told him, are you sure Swami told you in the dream? He said, yes, I'm convinced. I said, if you're sure that Swami has told you, then if that is Swami's will, it is bound to happen. I said, if I was in your position, I would have gone and spoken to the parents of that girl without actually telling that Swami has told me to do it. Because if I have the conviction that Swami is guiding it, then even if the whole world comes against, this is bound to happen, right? So I'm not going to mention the fact that Swami told me to do it, because that would be a way of biasing and influencing them. But at the same time, it shows my total conviction that I'm going and telling that this is what I think is good. Or I would take my parents along and tell my parents to ask the parents of that girl for that girl's hand. That's it. No bringing Swami in between. And it's amazing. It is nice to state that, yeah, this happened 4-5 years ago. Finally, that is what the boy did actually. And today they are happily married. What I'm trying to say is, if we have the conviction, then it should show in our action. I mean, if I'm really convinced Swami has told me this, honestly, will you have the need to go and tell someone, hey, I'm doing this because Swami told me. See, okay, I know that it seems nonsensical. I know it seems illogical, but Swami told me. Why should I tell Swami told me? If I'm having the conviction Swami told me, I'll go and tell, I want to do this. If they tell it's illogical, it may be illogical, but I'm going to do this. And if we actually look at life experiences I'm not getting any readily, but I remember a lot of the seniors and elderly devotees who were physically with Swami have actually followed this, wherein when Swami gives them an instruction, they go and execute the instruction without actually letting the other person know that it is Swami who told me. Because it is their conviction that when Swami has said it is the best thing to be done, I need not, you know, assign blame onto Swami. And now I recollect an incident of same Professor Nanjundaya, when he said that on one occasion, after Swami completed his discourse, Swami was sitting in his room above, and Nanjundaya sir was sitting at his feet, pressing his feet. And then Professor Kasturi comes walking up, and Swami looks at Professor Nanjundaya and asks him, Nanjundaya, how was Professor Kasturi's translation today? And Professor Kasturi is not looking at Swami, he is looking at Professor Nanjundaya. Professor Nanjundaya is looking at Swami, and as he is about to answer, Swami signals as if to say, it was very bad. And so Professor Nanjundaya promptly says, Swami, it was very, very bad. And Professor Kasturi has a shocked look on his face, because apparently, as Professor Nanjundaya sir recently confessed, he had done a pretty good job. He was just saying it because Swami said it. And then Kasturi looks and Swami says, is it so, Nanjundaya? Why? Where was he bad? And again makes an even more horrible face to say that it was terribly bad. And Professor Nanjundaya goes on to say that Swami was saying something, he was translating something else. I think he was not being a open pipe for, he was not being an open channel for Swami's message, and that's why his own views got into the message, and so it was not good and all that. And at the end of that, when Swami told Kasturi to leave, Professor Kasturi actually left with a huff, because he felt that here was somebody who was putting him down, God knows with what agenda.
Actually, I think it's, that episode portrayed what a balanced person Kasturi also was. Mm-hmm. Because apparently when first Nanjundaya sir said that it was not good, Professor Kasturi, you know, he kind of had an inkling that this was what was happening.
Uh-huh, okay.
So Professor Kasturi said, Swami, it was good only, but here and there maybe it was bad.
Oh, okay.
And
yes,
then
yes.
Swami asked Nanjundaya sir, so was it bad here and there, or was it bad completely? And then again Swami indicates to say completely. He said, no, Swami, not here and there. Completely it was bad.
So,
right, and he did not have the opportunity to convey this to Kasturi for a very long time.
In fact, right. If I remember right, Swami told him that you don't tell that I told this to Kasturi.
Right. And Professor Nanjundaya sir was telling that, you know, that never influenced Professor Kasturi's behavior towards Nanjundaya sir, which showed, you know, his understanding and maturity as a devotee. That's what Professor Nanjundaya would say.
Yes, I feel this incident is so beautiful because it shows both these devotees in such good light. One thing is, Professor Nanjundaya, you know, I feel if I was in his place, immediately that gets to I'll go and tell, hey, sorry man, I didn't mean it. You know, what to do? Swami told me here. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm telling that, see, I followed Swami. But I might have followed him in word, but in spirit I'm defeating it because I feel that what Swami did was not right. I need to take some steps to rectify it. That's why I'm going and clarifying that, you know what, don't get upset with me. If you have to get upset with him only, because he's the one who did it. You know, I'm using Swami as my shock absorber instead of being a shock absorber for Swami in that sense, you know. So I feel that is what it is. Conviction is so, so very important. So when even here Swami says that duty is God, but when Swami calls, you need not worry. It is loving on Swami's part to give that assurance. But the very fact that I am feeling guilty shows that I am not possibly convinced that whatever Swami says is the best for me. If Swami now tells you quit your job, stop doing anything, just sit at home and meditate, eat food 3 times a day, nothing else you need to do. If I even start thinking, but Swami, or start weighing pros and cons, it shows that my conviction in him is not 100%. So I think, personally for me, this short interaction gives me a very strong message that when I say I believe Swami is God, I have faith in Swami, is my conviction 100% or does it depend on what Swami is giving me as instruction? If my faith in him depends on what instruction he's giving, then it is not faith. Irrespective of what he says, I should be ready to do, you know, implicitly. That kind of conviction, if I have alone, you know, can I say that I have faith in Swami?
Right, and pretty much this is what, you know, Swami says about Sarva Dharman Parityajat. You know, all other dharmas fade when God comes into the picture. And an example of that is throughout the Mahabharata world, that's what happens. You know, whenever Krishna says it is goodness on the part of Pandavas or even Yudhishthira for that matter, they hesitate to follow him completely when it comes in certain places, you know, where it looks like Krishna is asking them to do something which is unrighteous. But that's a very, very important point that Swami is saying here. You know, when it comes to, it's a question of prioritizing. Are you able to prioritize God and in every other duty, every other responsibility gets its importance only if you think that that is going to lead you to God or that is going to please Swami, not otherwise. As we say, I mean, nothing in the spiritual path which you do in the physical realm is going to give you any spiritual benefit. Wearing a certain kind of clothes, having grooming yourself in a certain manner. But Swami says if you do any of that thinking that this might please Swami, then it has value, not by itself. If you're having a clean shaven face does not have a value of its own, wearing whites does not have a value of its own. But if you think that by doing this, maybe Swami will be pleased, I think even if we are wrong sometimes, it doesn't matter. The attitude itself will, you know, carry that action through.
And you know, extrapolating that same thought, I think that should be our attitude irrespective of what we do. You know, we may be in the organization, we may be in the central trust, we may be working in Radio Sai, wherever we are working, if we are having it firmly entrenched in our mind and heart that I am doing this as an offering of love to Swami, then, you know, thoughts such as jealousy, you know, I did so much but that fellow is getting all the credit, you know, this person is like this only, he does favoritism, I am the best singer yet I don't get a chance to sing in Kulwant Hall. You know, these are kinds of situations that we see even in our Sri Satya Sai organization, we see it everywhere. And all this comes because possibly, though I would like to do everything for Swami, unconsciously I am doing it to increase the number of beneficiaries of my seva or to impress the higher-ups, the district president, state president or the country head, whatever. You know, unconsciously I am doing it to impress others or to do, with an objective other than making Swami happy. Because if truly the objective is to make Swami happy, then I will not be concerned about the results, who is getting the credit, who is getting the praise, who is getting the blame. This is a kind of mantra that I keep thinking when I feel disappointed, you know, when I get disappointed professionally or personally because I am feeling that the results are not proportionate or commensurate to the efforts that I have put in. I ask myself this question, Arvind, for what or whom did you put this effort for? If you have done it for Swami, then you should look at what Swami is thinking, what Swami is saying, and ask Swami what he feels about it. Why are you bothered about what X, Y or Z is saying or whether X, Y and Z is giving recognition or not or whether the world is recognizing you or not? This is a very, very nice mantra, a very nice thing, a very nice question to ask ourselves. If we can truly do everything, like you said, not just shaving, not just putting on our whites, everything we are doing with the feeling that I am doing this to make my Swami happy, I think that will lead to a drastic and dramatic perspective change in life.
I think at this point we'll take a break because the next question that Hislop asks and Swami is going to elaborate on is a completely different topic and a very important one. Of course, though we are saying that these are different themes and different topics, they are all very subtly connected. But dear listeners, don't go away. We'll take a short break. On the other side of the song, we'll continue this beautiful conversation that Dr. Hislop has recorded with Swami.
Darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do चरण कमल पर अर्पण करो मन चरण कमल पर अर्पण करो मन करुणामृत भगवान करो भगवान, हर पल हर क्षण गाते
Dear listeners, we were just mentioning that at this point, Hislop asked a question which is different from what was being discussed so far. The question that Hislop asked is, when I'm absent from Swami's physical person and far away in America, I know of his actual presence by the jasmine perfume. Someone said it was smelled by the smell sense of the subtle body. Is this correct? And Swami's reply to that is, no, senses are in the physical body. The subtle body does not have senses. The perfume is known by the physical senses. And Hislop further asks, does man have three bodies? And Swami's reply to that is, yes, body, mind and soul. Physical body, subtle body and the causal body. On death, the physical and subtle bodies disintegrate, but the causal body remains. And of course, further there are questions, should we complete that part? Yeah. Hislop then goes on to ask, I think it's in the same theme, so we'll finish that question also. How about the five koshas, the five sheaths? And Swami replies, the food sheath, the life sheath, the mind sheath are impermanent. The intelligence sheath and the bliss sheath remain. The body is mud. Out of the mud grows everything. Only the body dies. Life and all the senses merge into the mind. The mind merges into wisdom. Sorry, and wisdom merges into bliss, into God. Thus, there are five sheaths. So this is the discussion that Hislop has, starting off with that question that he asked about feeling Swami's presence. I think that again is a experience which is very, very common. I know many, many devotees have come to Swami. This must have been their first experience. In fact, one of my classmates was once saying that he was living as a bachelor when he was doing his engineering or something. And he had taken a small room, something like a studio apartment, and he was staying there. And there he would sense Swami's presence through that, you know, jasmine
smell,
perfume. So he was very, very thrilled. And he was saying that, I was absolutely convinced that I'm not imagining it and it is Swami's presence, because I was a bachelor living in the most dirtiest of rooms. And, you know, there is no other way that there could be a fragrance like that. And in fact, he said a few months later when his parents visited him, the moment they walked into the room, they said, we are getting that fragrance. And that was a validation for him. But he was saying that with all dirty linen lying all over the place, and, you know, you're cooking in the same place and you're not keeping it too clean, certainly it was Swami's presence.
I think when you say bachelor's pad, it's understood.
It's understood. Everything goes with that. Right? But that's an experience that a lot of devotees have. But the clarification that Swami is giving here is very, very important.
Yes. I think the moment you say that his mother, father could also smell it, it becomes clear that it's not some sort of a spiritual experience. It is a physical experience. Of course, that is coming by the grace of Swami. So many times it happens, you know, because we are so steeped in the physical and mental realms, the experiences that Swami grants us are in these realms, so that we are able to appreciate it and understand it and feel Swami's grace. I think, you know, this is a thought that has been in me for very long. I think that by the sheer fact that we have stayed close to the physical presence of Swami, a lot of spiritual blessings must have flown on us, must have come on us through Bhagwan. But, you know, at the end of 2 years of staying with Swami, I don't think we feel anything special or anything uplifting. Possibly because we are not mature enough, we are not grown enough to appreciate the spiritual blessings. At the same time, that photo that Swami granted us, a ring that possibly materialized for us, all that we remember because we are so immersed in these sheets, the physical and the mental world. That also, you know, emphasizes the point we made a little time before, that it's not only about God giving, how we receive it is also so important. That's why Swami would also say that after completion of darshan, find a silent corner for yourselves to receive the completion of my blessings. If just by darshan everything could have been got, why would Swami say that, no, you put in some efforts to receive the completion? You can finish darshan and walk about. The very fact that you have had darshan, it should all be done, right? No. So all these points are so beautifully highlighted over here. And Swami goes on, you know, again, he emphasizes saying that the Annamaya Kosha, the Pranamaya Kosha and the Manomaya Kosha, all these three koshas will be gone. It's only the Vijnanamaya Kosha, that is the sheath of knowledge, and the Anandamaya Kosha, which is the sheath of bliss. Only these two are going to remain. This again gives us a very powerful hint on what we should strive for in life. if we see what we are striving for in life, almost all the things that we seek and that we want to gather and collect come in the Annamaya, Pranamaya or Manomaya Kosha. We are not gathering anything in the Vijnanamaya, that is wisdom and knowledge, and the Anandamaya, which is bliss, in these koshas. But unfortunately, it is only the things accumulated in these two koshas that we can carry on across births. These are the permanent things. All other things are impermanent. I remember you giving the example of, you know, going through the security at an airport and you're not allowed to carry so many things on board the aircraft. You can't. You're stopped. What is the use of shopping indiscriminately for all such things which will not be allowed onto the aircraft? You'll have to finally throw them in the bins and then go ahead on your journey. It makes more sense to accumulate and collect those things which are allowed to carry on. In the same way, when Swami is so clearly saying that your three koshas, that is Annamaya, Pranamaya, Manomaya, they don't go along, you can't carry them along, shouldn't we put in efforts and strive to gather things that belong to the Vijnanamaya and Anandamaya kosha?
Right, and the explanation that Swami is giving, in fact, there is a lot of discussion today about the subtle body, right? When Swami speaks about the three bodies, the Sanskrit terminology of that is Stula Sharira, Sukshma Sharira and Karana Sharira. The gross, the subtle and the causal bodies. There are a lot of talks these days about Swami's subtle body doing certain things and Sukshma Sharira doing certain things. The importance of looking at it in a very, very impassionate manner. You know, of course, it's an emotional thing for all of us, but keeping that aside, here is a group which is claiming that, you know, this is Swami's subtle body which is giving darshan, the subtle body which is speaking. And in fact, when we have done an article, the article's name is Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba Speaking on the Three Bodies, right? It's an article, it's a very extensive article, culling out whatever Swami has said about the subtle bodies, about such experiences, especially, in fact, this portion of the conversations is there in that article, and that's the first time I read it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a very academic article which says that what does Swami say about the subtle body, right? Here is a group which is saying that this is what Swami is telling about the subtle body. This is just contesting that. This is what Swami had explained for 70, 80 years about this concept of the subtle body. And here is a group which is just using that terminology and giving a completely different picture. So even theologically, even looking at it from the point of theory, it is completely wrong.
Nonsense,
and,
actually.
Right, and they are selling an idea and we are buying that. And what Swami says here is very important. See that Swami is not dismissing the experience. Hislop is saying that I can feel your fragrance, right? Swami is not dismissing the experience, but he's saying, but don't call that a subtle body. I mean, that's a totally different concept altogether. Because Swami has spoken about this, in fact, maybe a couple of minutes about what Swami says, that we all go through this physical body, the subtle body, and Swami says the five sheaths which Swami speaks about, Swami says only the Annamaya Kosha is the physical body, right? It's the physical body when it is dropped, it's only the food, it's made out of food. You know, when we were born, we were 3 kgs and today we are 70, 80, 90 kgs. This is nothing but food, right? So Swami says this body is food. And then you have the Pranamaya, Manomaya and, Pranamaya and Manomaya. That form the subtle body, right? With the senses, what we refer to as the sense organs, the five pranas which are running through and the mind. And then Swami says the Vijnanamaya is, and the bliss.
Anandamaya.
Right, Anandamaya. They constitute the causal body or the Karana Sharira. And Swami explains this very beautifully, you know. What we experience in the process of sleep and what we experience at the time of death is very similar. You know, when we go to sleep, what happens is the senses are withdrawn into the subtle, right? The prana is allowed to remain in the body. There's this very beautiful allegory that the Upanishads give. It is like a village where everybody goes to sleep in the village, but only the bonfires are kept burning, so that the wild animals don't come and so that the warmth is maintained, you know, around the caravan or whatever like that. So the analogy the Upanishads give is everything is withdrawn, only the five pranas are made to remain in the body, right? So that the body is kept alive. That's why when you go to sleep, you don't die. You know, you're kept alive. There's continuity of, you know, after you wake up the next morning, you continue with the life in that sense. So they say that when you go to sleep, the pranas are allowed to remain in the physical body. the senses are completely withdrawn into the subtle, and the subtle experiences the dream state.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why in the dream you can do all kinds of activities. You don't get tired. You know, maybe you run a mile, but your body doesn't get tired. You travel, but you don't get seasick, or you don't get travel fatigue, nothing like that. Because all of this is in the mental, the subtle body goes through this whole thing. And then when you go into deep sleep state, the Upanishads say that even the subtle body is withdrawn into the Karana Sharira. And that is why you're completely still. There is no agitation in the mind or anything like that. What they say is something very similar happens when a person dies. The only difference is the pranas are not allowed to stay in the body. The pranas also are withdrawn along with the senses into the sukshma sharira. Mm-hmm. And something similar to the dream state happens, what we refer to as the soul going to the heaven or hell, where you don't have a body, but you experience that pain, experience that happiness for a brief period. So what we refer to as Swarga or Naraka or heaven and hell is nothing but a dreamlike state where the mind undergoes a certain suffering depending on the good or bad actions that you have done. And then when you, after that, the Sukshma Sharira is again withdrawn into the Karana Sharira. Something similar to a deep sleep state is experienced even by the soul. And then depending on your karmas, you're made to take another birth. Just like how the next morning you wake up, the same process reverses, right? The Sukshma Sharira returns from the Karana, which means the deep sleep is gotten over. Then the Sukshma Sharira again infests into this body and then you wake up. Something similar happens when you take a rebirth, right? And one of the best examples that I heard, or best analogies that I heard, is, you know, you can experience that when you go to a food counter, right? The person uses a glove, right, before they give you your order or whatever it is. So the person, first what they do is, you go and tell them that I want this particular object for food. It happens even in our, you know, Isharama counter. You go and say that I want a plate of idli, or I want a plate of dosa. The first thing that lady in the counter does is, she puts her hand into a glove, right? And then she serves you, and then she discards that glove. It's a disposable glove they use. That glove can be equated to the human body. So every time there is a reason for that person to wear the glove, that person wears the glove, completes the task, and then the glove is discarded, just like how this body is discarded. And then the person withdraws the hand. The hand can be spoken of as the Sukshma Sharira, right? And the person who is actually thinking and responding to your order can be equated to the Vijnana and, you know, the actual Karana Sharira. So when there is no order, or when there is no reason for that person to act, the person does not put his hand into a glove. So what Swami says is, when there is no reason for a soul to manifest again in the human body, then there is no, you know, reincarnation. When there is a reason, the same thing happens. The Sukshma Sharira is projected from the Karana Sharira. The Sukshma Sharira enters a body, and then birth happens. And the reason why I'm saying this is, when you say that Swami is going around in the Sukshma Sharira, it is completely wrong from the viewpoint of Vedanta, from the viewpoint of Swami's own message, which is actually nothing but Vedanta. There is no difference in the two. So you are telling something which is a completely spiritual mumbo jumbo, which does not qualify in any of these parameters. And your entire narrative is based on this sham. I think that's, even as Swami's devotees who are very, very keen on reading Swami's message should remember this. This is not true at all. This is not right in any stretch of imagination.
You know, it is so clear, because Swami mentioned that subtle body also leaves along with the physical body. And yet we have thousands and thousands who have been fooled by the subtle body nonsense. It just shows that it is important for us to steep ourselves into what Swami has said,
right,
rather than what others are saying that Swami has said. You know, that's why many times, you know, we were discussing this even yesterday, day before. It is not important that people tune into Radio Sai and YouTube channel and watch what the radio jockeys are saying, or what people are saying, or what is being said in Kulwant Hall. No, please. The greatest, greatest treasure that Radio Sai has to offer is the treasure trove of Bhagwan's own discourses. I mean, if you have the Radio Sai app on your phone, just imagine in two taps, you just tap it twice and you are able to listen to the nectarous flow of Bhagwan's divine discourse. The Ganga is there, available at your doorstep, the spiritual Ganga. And yet, You know, I really think how many of us actually use the Radio Sai app or the Radio Sai YouTube channel or whatever, you know, to listen to Bhagwan's own words. I'm very sad to say this, and I'm including myself also in this. More than the truth, we actually want entertainment and a way to spend our time pleasurably. You know, in the last Guru Purnima discourse, Swami said, man seeks pleasure so desperately, even when he is 90-year-old and on the verge of death, he tells the doctor, can you not give me that injection and give me a sugar pill instead? And Swami says, chah, at that age, without gaining wisdom, you are still going behind Sukham. There also you want Sukham. You still feel that you want Sukham. What is the use? We are so much, you know, we confuse our quest for Ananda as quest for pleasure. And that is why, you know, even if I want to tune into Radio Sai or, you know, Radio Sai's YouTube or whatever it is, you know, I am looking for that entertainment quotient. Very sad to say, but that is the truth, you know. Even the videos that we put up which possibly gathers more number of views or likes are the videos which are a little higher on the entertainment quotient. That's all it is. It's nothing but disguised marketing in the name of spirituality. That's all. We are so much seeking entertainment. We just think that I don't watch movies, I'm fully on Radio Sai. But in Radio Sai also, I don't listen to Swami's discourses. I watch these videos, I see those things which have entertainment factor. I am just kidding myself, replacing movie with something that is entertaining. Possibly, yes, it is a safer, slightly safer entertainment. It's better entertainment. You won't have foul words coming in. You won't have, you know, a warning of 13 plus or 18 plus or parental guidance. It can be watched and viewed by everyone, of course. So in that sense, it is better, but that is not the true treasure. That is not the true treasure that is there on offer. So that is the problem. That is the reason why we are vulnerable and we are gullible and we become fools and suckers falling for such nonsensical theories being propounded, propagated and being used to embezzle money, embezzle funds. We fall for it simply because we don't know. We don't know because we don't make efforts and take initiative to dive into the treasure that has been offered to us. It's not like, you know, I used to think even something like 30 years before, so difficult it is if you want to research something. You go to the library, that book should be there. Even if you know that it's in the book, where in that book? You have to search 300 pages. No, everything within tap of buttons, it's all there. All of Swami's discourses, all of Swami's Vahinis, everything is available if you just want to. It's so easy. Yet how many of us go through even one discourse a day?
I'll tell you something absolutely paradoxical. There used to be a person who used to work in the Books and Publications Trust and was, you know, very, very fascinated by what was happening in Mudan Ali and the kind of things which were going on there. And one day he came and asked me, and he had the cheek, I think he did not know from where, what are our thoughts about it. He came and asked me, you know, can you tell me, how can I procure a book, where, he gave me a name. I said, what book is that? I've never heard of that. He said, no, these are compilations of discourse which are being given by Swami in Mudan Ali. Is this a person who is working in book trust? I said, sir, why on earth would you want to read that book? He said, no, there are some things which Swami is telling now, which Swami has not told in the past. I said, can you give me an example? He said, like about the three bodies. Swami has not spoken about it. I said, how can you even say this? Because whatever I said, you know, just a while ago is what Swami has told, you know, in conversations with Hislop. Swami has told in his own Vahinis. Sandeha Nivarani and Prashnottara Vahini, Swami speaks extensively about the three bodies. There are many discourses in 1991 summer course, Swami has spoken about the three bodies. He said, do you even know that Swami has spoken so extensively about it? And he said, oh, is that so? I mean, that is the kind of state we are in. To make it even more worse, it's a person who is working in the Books and Publications Trust, which have been bringing out these discourses all these years. And that's the mistake we are doing. And that very thought, you know, as people who have physically waited there for one word of Swami, right? One word, if Swami would come and say that, even if it was like, you know, what is your name or where do you come from? It was enough. Juxtapose that with now, with a tap of a button, you can listen to Swami's voice. How many of us avail this opportunity which has come, right? And I mean, that's really a pity in that sense that we are not turning to Swami's words enough.
And also the irony in what you said is that Swami himself in his discourses on multiple times has said that there is nothing new for me to tell you. Even whatever I am telling you is ancient wisdom. It is the most ancient. Yet it is ever new. Nitya Nutana and Satya Sanatana. It is the ancient truth which is ever new. That's all it is. And a Swami who states that, which we have record of, the so-called subtle body of Swami, which means, as you say, in theory itself is nonsense, is coming and saying that, no, this is a new message, this is a modified, this is the latest. Swami's message is Satya Sanatana, it's not a fad. It's not a fad that rises every 5-6 years and then goes and you need an updation. We hold on to Swami because we want something eternal. We are in the quest of something eternal. We are tired in life with all the things that are temporary, which are passing clouds, and we realize that nothing is going to give me permanent eternal joy. And that's why we come to Him for seeking something eternal. And you have a so-called representation of that Swami telling that, no, these are changes, and you fall for it. You know, one can only feel sad, but and that's all it is.
I mean, as we've pointed out, it is not anybody's mistake but ours. Right, we have not gone into Swami's words. We have not, given as much importance to Swami's words as we should have. And I think that is the mistake. And this is not to point out anybody else. Maybe our good fortune is we did not fall for it. But we still do not fall under the category that who were well informed and did not fall for it.
Correct.
Right. I mean, after dismissing that, probably we have read Swami's words and saying that, you know, see, Swami himself has said, but it is not the other way around. So we do not, in that sense, fall in the category of people who have taken Swami's words seriously and read it. And so we are dismissing that.
Absolutely.
So,
I think
that's a very important thing that it is for us to blame that if tomorrow someone comes and says that, you know, this is what is being said in Swami's name, not only in Mudanil, any other place, you know, this is what so-and-so is saying, Swami is speaking through that person. I think we should be able to tell categorically that, no, this is not Swami's philosophy. This is not the message that Swami has given. If we could give it with reference, I think that would be, that would show how diligent we are. But at least otherwise, are we convinced intellectually that this cannot be what Swami has said? Through our conscience, through our inner connect with Swami, yes, that is the best. But even intellectually, we are not able to refute some of these claims that people are making.
So on that note, dear listeners, we will take another quick little break. On the other side of the break, we will continue with the conversation that Hislop is having with Swami, because, you know, Hislop then speaks about the 14 lokas. You know, the three bodies is one thing, then he speaks about the lokas and many other interesting such themes. All this after the break.
Shamukha Mardana Rama Rama ಸರಂಜನ ತಾರಕ ನಾಮ ಸರಂಜನ ಸರಂಜನ ತಾರಕ ನಾಮ
listeners, we move on to the next theme where Hislop now tells Swami, what are the 14 lokas, the 14 worlds? And Swami says, they are really thoughts. There are 7 levels of thought ascending upwards and 7 downward. Then Hislop says, Swami, some people claim to travel on the astral plane by projecting their minds. And Swami immediately comes in and says, it is like dreams or visions, it is not real. However, if vision appears in meditation, it is of something real. You know, again, this is another thing, you know, people often talk very bizarre and talk all, you know, like these mumbo jumbo stuff to confuse you and make you feel that you are in the presence of a spiritually elevated soul. They say, in my astral travel, I saw this and this is what it is. And I've heard very, very strong proponents of the current subtle body, sukshma sharira business actually doing all these talks on doing an astral travel, seeing, helping Swami at an astral level, you know, all these kind of nonsense being spoken. At that time, you know, I must confess that I also was pretty impressed and I used to think, yes, Swami, I have even thought of, you know, mentally prayed, Swami, I also want to not just help you physically, I also want to help you astrally and all that. All that, you know, Swami is just debunking so straight away. I just feel bad that I didn't read all these. I didn't go through the treasures that Swami has given. Is it Swami's fault? Like you said, it is my own fault. You know, one thing that struck me over here is when Swami is saying that when you're projecting and talking, when you're projecting, the mind is focused on so many things. It's just like imagination. That's why Swami is saying it's imagination. When I'm imagining, if somebody tells me, imagine a beautiful day, you're in the field, you know, for me to I experience some kind of joy, definitely. But I am projecting my mind and building up so many things. I have to build up the field, the sweet sounds of the birds, the fresh smell of dew, the green grass, the blue sky, the lovely clouds. So much, you know. So it's almost like mind is focused on so many, focusing on multiple things and building up all these things. And Swami says, you know, that is imagination only. Whether you call it as a travel in astral plane or whether you call it as imagination, it is just that. But Swami says, when the vision appears in a meditation, then it is something real. Now again, it's not absolute real, but some parts of it is real. For me, it just felt like, this is my interpretation of course, what I'm saying. For me, it felt like, when you're focused on only one thing and spontaneously other things are emerging, some amount of realism is there because that is something spontaneous that is arising from your inner recesses. But when you yourself are focusing and building up 100 things, then you something comes there and you're telling that was the light that was delivered to me, that was a travel in astral plane. All that is nothing but imagination.
Right. You know, there are some of these experiences that some devotees have had. For instance, the experience that Mr. James Sinclair speaks about when Swami appeared in his apartment in New York, right? He says that he has never seen Swami before. He has never seen a form like that. If you compare that with some of us, you know, as I would always say that, you know, I'm constantly seeing Swami's videos, I'm constantly seeing, reading and listening to Swami and all of that. If I start talking about some vision like that, I mean, I would myself take it with a pinch of salt because, you know, you're feeding your mind with all these kind of visual media which is related to Swami. And it's quite obvious that probably in a dream that you think of Swami or when you're sitting and, you know, trying to meditate, images of Swami come. I'm not dismissing all of that, but I think you can take it with a pinch of salt that, you know, it could be your mind. And sometimes I feel that, you know, even that kind of dreams is fine. That is a sign that waking time, I'm giving enough time to Swami that even in the dreams, even through indigestion, I think Swami is coming. So I think that is a good sign. But if you talk about these visions of people who have never seen Swami, who never had any kind of association with Swami's physical appearance, for them, if in a vision Swami comes, like I think even Victor Kanu speaks of an experience like that. The first time he has a dream in which he does some kind of an astral travel where he goes to a loka where he sees many of his ancestors, and they bring him to a place which he has never seen before. It only appears like an Indian architecture and, you know, all kinds of weird things that he sees. Then many years later, when he comes to Prashanthinilayam for the first time, when he's driving in the car through the Gopuram gate, he recognizes that this is the same thing that he had seen in a dream. He saw the same structure, he saw the same pink and blue and yellow buildings. And, you know, then he says that, oh, this was a vision that Swami had. So I think Swami is saying that it's not to dismiss all visions, but actually it plays a very, very small role in our spiritual journey. We don't realize that. In fact, you know, when I was going through the Bhagavad Gita for the other program, at one point Krishna speaks about the Karma Yoga. He says, do whatever you do as an offering to God. Do whatever you do with your mind focused on the ultimate goal and all of that. And then at the end of it, Krishna says, look, this is the ultimate message. If you follow this, you get redeemed. If you don't follow this, and you will get deluded further and more and more. Everything else is only superfluous. Right? He says the final thing is this. Are you able to do with everything as an expression of love for God dedicatedly? So if you look at it, that is always the spiritual journey. How much are you able to do out of your love for God, right? Whether you have visions, whether you have a vision of light, whether you have a vision of astral travel, all of that probably is only the
bells and whistles.
Right? Everything else is only a frill that is being attached. I think that is the approach that we all should have also, not to dismiss people who have had visions and dreams and a lot of insightful learnings through these visions. But I think as an aspirant, when you are approaching the spiritual path, we need not give so much importance to these and crave for these instead of, you know, the real thing what Swami speaks about.
The next part, dear listeners, actually Swami goes into quite some detail and the discussion is on time. And both Prem and I, we want to confess that it takes quite a lot of effort to even intellectually understand it. And it's not that we have got a very precise and clear idea of what Swami is saying. That's why we thought that We will quickly go through the conversation between Hislop and Swami so that it remains in our subconscious. We can mull over it and hopefully both of us will have some more insights and some more understanding thanks to Swami's grace to share in detail in the next satsang. At the same time, it also gives you, dear listeners, a week's time to do share your understanding with us, because it's just, as I said, we are all equal in this satsang, global satsang that is happening. It just happens that the mic is in front of both of us and the you know, phones and radio sets are with you. So please, as we go through this, please think over it. Please do write to us with your thoughts, with your understanding. This is a satsang. May we grow together in our understanding. It's with that objective only we will, you know, both Prem and myself will read through this conversation bit between Hislop and Swami on time. So it starts off with Hislop saying, time is set by the clock, and on the clock, each minute is same as the next. But in one's life, time goes slow in one experience and extremely fast in the next. And Swami says, Hislop goes to sleep in Bombay. He dreams that he is born in California and he lives through 65 years of life. Yet, this entire 65 years takes only 2 minutes of actual clock time. Hislop has gone to sleep in Bombay, but the Bombay body is left behind. This is proof that Hislop is not the body. To the Jnani, the wise man, who has wakened to wisdom, 65 years of waking life is just a moment like the dream to Hislop. And I think as Swami is speaking this also, I think Swami must have been nearing his 65th birthday, is it? Or it's much before that?
Possibly, I think.
So, 1980s. That is the thing. And Hislop goes on to the next question where he says, what is this present moment then? And Swami replies, God is omnipresent. He is ever present. This moment is God. There is only God. Truth is the same in the past, in the present, and it will remain the same in the future. Therefore, the time sequence of past, present, future is just imagination. But I am timeless, beyond time. I looks at past, present, and future. They are not me. I mean, the past, present, and future are not me. Of course, past, present, and future must be taken into account in daily affairs. These two aspects of time must be mixed and in operation at the same time. The perception that the time sequence is only imagination, that I am timeless and beyond time, both should be there at the very moment that one is using the time sequence in his daily affairs.
Right. So I think multiple things Swami is saying here. The first part, of course, is understandable. The question that Hislop is asking is very good. I mean, it's a common one. In fact, Albert Einstein speaks about it. You know, in his theory of relativity, he gives the example of sitting on a hot stove versus sitting next to a very pleasant lady that you'd like to spend time with, right? Where he says one time seems to move faster. In fact, there's a very beautiful incident which Ravikumar sir, who is the warden of Vrindavan campus, he was narrating that Swami had called, I think, all the teachers for an interview. And in the interview, Swami said, if you have any questions, you can ask. And somebody had asked questions about the kings of the past, you know, kings like Vikramaditya or Chandragupta Maurya and all that. And they were asking whether, you know, these are all one personalities or are these, you know,
titles
that have come over a period of time. So Swami was saying, yeah, some of them are Vikramaditya. Swami said there have been many. And if you have you know, won these many battles, or if you govern an area as large as this, then you get that title. And Swami was telling about all of that. And then Swami was talking about, you know, how time is recorded, or how, why, if you look at it, sometimes Indian history is a bit vague on time, right? You don't have that kind of a very precise you know, record of these many years, or, you know, this is exactly the year in which it was born. In fact, the way it is recorded is a little different. It was all marked astrologically. If you read even Ramayana and Mahabharata, the events are recorded based on the constellations. You know, when this happened, this was the you know, precise arrangement of the constellations.
This planet was in this star. And
right, and it was not to mark, you know, like in BC or AD or anything like that, but it was understood that time was cyclical and these kind of placements came in a regular basis, and it was marked that at one particular time when the placement was like this, it happened. Hmm. So it was a very different way of recording time. So Swami was talking about all of that, and then Swami said, see, that it's because from the Vedantic point of view, from the Indian spiritual point of view, time has a very relative importance. It is not so important. Right? And Swami was narrating some of these things. And even as they were talking, I think the bhajan started or something like that. And Swami said, hey, already it's time. It's been 1 hour.
Mm.
Okay. And when Swami said that, everybody realized that the time spent so fast when Swami was talking. And Swami said, see, none of you realized that we spent so much time. None of you felt that 1 hour passed. See, that is why time is not very important. Time is based on your thinking, right? And what Swami is saying here is very much that. In fact, I think it has come or it has not yet come in this particular way. Swami speaks about the four aspects which govern the physical world. Karma, Kala, Kartavya.
Yes, it was, I think, one of the first earliest conversations.
So Swami says that when you come into the physical, it is bound by these four aspects. Karma, Kala, Kartavya and Karana, right? Then Swami gives the same example. So in the dream, all of that does not stand good. So when Swami says the body or the physical itself is an imagination, and what you talk of time is in the imaginary field, right? So that's why Swami is saying in the subtle field, when the mind is going through the dream world, time collapses. So when in the subtle world itself it collapses, then you can imagine in the Karana from that level. There is no concept of time. There is no idea of past and the present and all that. I mean, that's as far as theoretically we can talk about it. But as you said, it calls for a different experience altogether to be able to understand this thoroughly.
Also, when you say time collapses in the sukshma, that is in the sleep state, dream state. Just to add on that, when it collapses, it's not just about a lot being done in very less time. The reverse also takes place, you know. Extreme slowing also happens. Because just as I was sharing with you, last night I had a dream. I won't share the dream now. But that whole dream possibly spanned hours when I slept at night. But when I recollect the dream, in the dream state, it was possibly just a 10-minute or 15-minute talk that I was giving. So 15 minutes occupied the entire so many hours of sleep. So the other way also it happens. I mean, time gets dilated also. Basically, all the rules that we keep for time, you know, especially what Hislop is saying, time is set by the clock, and on the clock each minute is the same as the next. That doesn't happen in the dream. And in the same dream you might have had a situation where, you know, 1 minute is extra long. And then so much gets condensed in a very short time. So both the expansion, the dilation and the contraction of time, everything happens. So, yeah, as you rightly said, Swami says the construct of time collapses in the sukshma state itself. What then to speak of the karana state? So, dear listeners, just to complete it, two more sentences. We'll read that out and then conclude today's satsang. Hislop says, in terms of the unreality of time, how are we to experience past, present, future? And Swami says, they are unreal. Because time is unreal, they are also unreal. But at the same time, the Atma is real. Hold to that central reality. There need to be no confusion. The inward intelligence may harmonize the experience of the relative time and the permanent self. Even now, you are hearing and seeing, yet the inward intelligence coordinates the two. And then Hislop asks, at this moment, we seem to be as we are at this moment. When Swami looks at us with his eyes, what is it that he sees? And Swami replies, man has two eyes. He sees only past and present. God has three eyes. God's eyes are spiritual. He sees in front, behind, above and below. Like the garland pulled over the finger is the present and if it is in touch with past and future. God is in the present, he is omnipresent. As Baba looks at people, he sees the past, the present moment and the future. And everywhere, in every direction. So on that note, dear listeners, we will bring the satsang to a close. I reiterate that your thoughts, your understanding, your enlightenment is definitely welcome. Because we will receive it and we too shall contemplate on this. And possibly in the next satsang, next week, we will go a little bit into this. We are grateful to Swami for leaving behind this treasure trove, we pray that He gives us the wisdom, the knowledge, the understanding that when the Ganga is available here, I need not get some gutter water and drink it. Ganga is available in all her majesty, pristinity, crystal clarity. Let us partake the spiritual Ganga that Bhagwan has given and redeem our lives. We will end with a song, on the other side of which, as always, we'll be joined by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sundaram Bharatam Saralasumanoharam Vaibhavam Bharatam Madhurani Rajanam Sundaram Bharatam Saralasumanoharam Vaibhavam Bharatam మధురనీరాజనం హృదయమే పులకించెనే భరతగానామృతం అందరం పాడుదాం వందే మాతరం శీతలం శ్యామలం మాతరం సుమధుర భారతం సరళసుమనోహరం వైభవం భారతం మధురనీరాజనం భరతదేశం మనసాయి రాముడే జన్మించిన పుణ్యదేశం ఈ దేశ వ్యాప్తిలో సాయియుగం కనిపించను చూపులు ఆ సాయియుగము పరవళ్ళతో వీణమీటెను మనసులో సాయితో జీవితం మాకో వరం అనుక్షణం ప్రేమతో నిర్మించు మందిరం
ప్రతి కే మహావీరుకి రాహు పే చల్ బడతే జన శక్తి దిల్ కే సాగర్ మే రూప తేరా భక్తి దీజో మాం జినా హమే తేరే లియే
Thursday Live. Stay tuned.